So I just want to talk a little bit about our theme, and then we'll go into our first sit. So mindfulness meditation for pain relief. There's going to be three basic things we're going to focus on. The first is that since pain is inevitable, if you have a body, then we need to learn how to have an attitude around pain that doesn't make it worse. So pain happens physically, but most of our difficulty around pain is what we do with it mentally. We could say it's our relationship with pain that makes us suffer. The suffering is not in the physical pain. The suffering is in how we relate to it. So part of working with pain is to improve our attitude. We might even consider what's good about pain. If you were leaning on a stove and your body did not have the ability to feel pain, and you were leaning on an open flame on the stove, you wouldn't know it until you smelled the charred flesh. Pain is a helpful thing. It's your body trying to give you information that's helpful. So that's part of our exploration today. How do we make the best of what's hard? And we don't just experience pain, we experience sometimes illness that the pain comes with. And pain is part of an illness, and as we age, pain comes more frequently as the body starting to fall apart. How can that possibly be good? How can aging and illness be good? The Buddhist tradition actually calls pain and illness heavenly messengers, and I'm going to unpack that more in the talk in the afternoon. How could it possibly be a heavenly messenger, a message from heaven? Pain? Really? For real? Come on. So that's going to be part of our exploration too. We have to make peace with this because it's what's real. So a person goes to their doc and the doc measures their blood pressure. Got to get that down a bit. Let's get that down a bit. Takes their weight. Oh, got to get that down a bit. Looks at their cholesterol reading from their lab tests. Oh, we need to get that down a bit. How old are you? 57. We're going to need to get that down a bit. That's the basic rub. That's the basic rub. Is that we can try to prevent, you know, our blood pressure going up and our weight gain and this and that. We cannot prevent the inevitability of aging and illness and pain. So we better make peace with it. It's a reality need. So we're going to focus sort of on our attitude. Then we're going to focus on how to work directly with our experience in the body. And how do we actually work with difficult conditions? How do we work with pain in the body? And the basic template is we want to know how to turn towards it skillfully with mindfulness. And then we also want to know how to turn away from it. So we might think within a mindfulness context that we always and only just keep turning towards things and opening to them. And as long as you can, that's what I would recommend. Absolutely open and turn towards. But to only focus on pain can be kind of demoralizing and a drain of energy. So sometimes to work skillfully with pain, we need to really turn away. So the instructions I'm going to give you today as we go, I'm going to kind of do a sequence of instructions, are going to involve turning towards and turning away to difficult experiences. As we work with pain, we're going to really be working with the mind-body connection. As I said, that we have physical pain, but most of our difficulty with pain comes from our mental reaction to it, our relationship with it. And one of the hardest things to learn to do is to accept pain when it's here. We're normally in a lot of resistance. To accept and turn towards pain is hard, but super helpful. It's hard, but we can do it. If you can start the day without caffeine or pep pills, if you can be cheerful while ignoring aches and pains, if you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, if you can eat the same food every day and be thankful for it, if you can take criticism and blame without resentment, if you can face the world without lies and deceit, if you can relax without liquor, if you can sleep without the aid of drugs, then you must be a dog. So, and we actually can kind of get this. We can watch the animals that we know do really well with pain. In my neighborhood, every house has an apple tree in it because it was subdivided a long time ago as an orchard before it turned into suburbia. And so because there's so many apples, there's deer everywhere in the neighborhood. And we have a deer that comes to our yard a lot with a limp foot, and it breaks your heart to see this. And yet, I don't see the deer suffering. The deer just seems to somehow work with it. So there's a way in which we can learn a ton from animals on accepting what we can't change. And when there's physical pain and we can do something about it, great. And when we can't, we can still do something about it. We can change our relationship to it through our practice, through mindfulness. So that's really the essence of what we're doing today. So the first element is working with our relationship. The second element is to actually work with pain directly in the moment. And then the third element is exploring a little bit, if there's time, on how do we actually work with taking action around pain and working with the medical system and all of that. So how do we take action? So that's basically our focus today. So welcome back. So let's focus a little bit on how we can reform our attitude about pain. and then I want to unpack a little bit more how to actually work with pain, what we've already been doing this morning. So there's a little very pithy little slogan that really summarizes how mindfulness can be so helpful in working with pain. And it says, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. And so I'll talk about the optional part, but let's just first focus on the inevitable part. And somebody once said something like, freedom is cooperation with the inevitable. Could we possibly cooperate with the fact that if we have a body, we are bound to experience pain? And as we get older and age, that is likely to increase somehow, some way. Not necessarily, but it's just likely. So what on earth could be good about pain? And I want to refer to something a spiritual teacher, Byron Katie, likes to say. She likes to say that your difficulty is not happening to you. It's happening for you. So pain, we typically think of it sort of as an assault. I'm over here, pain is over there, and pain is afflicting me. So let's just contemplate as a group a little bit. How is it possible that pain would be happening for us? That how does pain actually serve us? Another way of asking it is, what's good about pain? An early warning system.
Yikes, something is going on.
And what is it warning you of?
My hand isn't working right now. I'm trying to get it fixed.
Right, okay. So it's a warning system that something might be wrong in the body that needs attention.
Right.
Okay? What else?
It protects us.
Say more. It protects us.
Your example earlier of the hot stove. So if we didn't have the pain, we may not be able to protect ourselves.
Right. So pain basically protects us from injury,
right.
Further injury. Similar to early warning system. Yeah, great, thanks. Please.
So I've had pain in my stomach for like 2 years maybe, and it just made me change my whole life, and my life has been changed in such a great way because I started meditation because of this pain, and I started going to Tai Chi, playing piano, and just doing a lot of things to calm myself down. I want to own my life, but it's making me so happy.
So I'm just going to repeat that for the mic and for everybody. So pain for you is basically a redirect. It's really improved your life. You've turned to meditation and piano and other things that help you feel better. Great. Thank you. Please.
I think it contrasts so sharply with non-pain. It makes you appreciate when you're not in pain.
Oh. So pain makes you appreciate when you're not in pain. So pain possibly is a call to gratitude. Maybe? Please.
First in that class, you used the example of living in Los Angeles, and it's nice every day, and you don't even notice it after a while. And that's kind of what you're saying is, I think back to when I was younger, and there's no pain, and that's the water you swim in, and then once you get some pain, you start looking more closely at the pleasure and
so similarly, then pain can really help you appreciate pleasure more. Without the pain, you don't even really know. Okay.
Compassion. Gives you compassion. Oh. It's given me compassion.
Ah. So it's really boosted compassion for you.
Well, yeah, because I can know maybe.
Yeah.
What other people are going through. And then experiencing a little more capacity for compassion.
So pain helps us relate. Pain in others really helps us. Well, pain in ourselves helps us understand the experience of others, and that helps us be more compassionate to others. Mm-hmm. Great. We're getting a pretty good list here. Uh-huh.
It really collects attention into the present moment.
Yes. Can you say more?
We do with that attention, but it's focus. Like it's hard to be off just daydreaming.
Oh. So pain really does kind of like pull you out of everything else and into the moment. Mm-hmm.
And I think it teaches, just as we've been working this morning, it's instructive in impermanence. Because even when pain feels, the body feels kind of solid, when investigated, it can see its kind of movement.
Hmm.
Transitory nature, so
it
can be a great teacher.
Mm. So it's a pull into feeling our body and seeing that, oh, our body is impermanent. So it's just another way to where the practice is, or it can be a teacher, it can be a redirect. So last one, yeah, and then I want to add one more to the list. No, please.
No, I was going to say it sort of tends to trigger my tenderness, and maybe it's both of what you were saying, compassion, and it brings you, do you know what I mean, that tenderness that is triggered when you're in pain, that tenderness for life, tenderness for others, just this immediacy of some sort that you wouldn't otherwise notice.
So it brings us, it invites us into a tenderness for others and for life. Wow. I mean, we could paste a whole list onto our fridge from that and might help us. Our group wisdom here. And I want to add one more to the list. And so as I said this morning, Buddhism has this, the story of the Buddha's awakening starts with the Prince Siddhartha. As the legend has it, or he was protected by his father from experiencing any suffering because a psychic had told him when he was born that Prince Siddhartha would either take over the kingdom from his father or become a spiritual teacher. And his father really did not want him to be a spiritual teacher, wanted the line to continue. So he wanted to shield him from pain and suffering so he lived in apparently a very, very pleasurable life. But when he was 29, he asked an attendant to take him out of the palace. And one day he saw a person who was getting old. And the next day he went out and he saw a sick person. Apparently he had been shielded from this his whole life. He then saw a dead person on the third day. And on the fourth day, he saw a renunciate, a spiritual seeker. And Prince Siddhartha decided on the sight of that to leave the palace as a prince and become a beggar and a seeker. And after going through tremendous pain and agony from all kinds of mortification practices, he realized that wasn't working. And so stumbled upon what we call the middle way between punishing and denying the self or indulging sensory pleasure. And the middle way helped the Buddha awaken into mindfulness in the practice we do today. So those four sights of old age, illness, death, and spirituality are what we call the heavenly messengers. So our tradition is not, our heavenly messengers are not light-filled angels on fluffy clouds. This being Buddhism, which is incredibly realistic, actually takes the poison of all these things which we think of as horrible, pain and illness and death, and turning them on their head, and not just helping us tolerate or neutralize the poison, but actually turn the poison into medicine. It's this brilliant move, because these are the realities of life, the inescapable realities. We get old, we hurt, we die. And those three things, in addition to everything else, are pointers to having a spiritual life. If we want to actually treat aging, illness, and death as messengers, we have to get spiritual. And in this tradition, the spiritual life is really considered a set of mental skills. The skill of mindfulness, the skill of loving kindness, and the skillful action in the world. That's the spiritual path. You're not being asked to believe in something you don't understand, something you can't experience. You're actually being asked to trust your experience and see what works, what actually works. And so you could look at aging, illness, and death as these pointers, as some of you are saying, to get more in the moment, to get our priorities straight, and to not fritter away our time. So they can be early warning systems, not just for something needs attention in the body, but an early warning system that something needs attention in your psyche. And these wouldn't be heavenly messengers if there wasn't the possibility of liberation, of actually coming into a place of pure presence. You know, we could think of liberation. There's many ways to look at it, but one way is that your mind is just hopelessly locked into the present moment awareness. We all want to be present. It doesn't matter if you want to meditate or not, right? We all understand that being present is kind of an optimum way of being. Present and aware. Being present is not quite enough, because we can be very present watching a movie, not lost in past and future, but not that aware. I mean, we're aware in the sense we know we're watching a movie, but it's not mindfulness. It's not actually realizing, oh, I'm sitting in a dark room. There's some dark heads in front of me, and there's light on a wall, and there's sound. And it's a vivid display, right? That's mindfulness. We know it's a movie. So present is necessary but not sufficient. We need to also be mindful and aware. Life is a movie. Life is a movie. Remember, I think it was Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the 70s had the tagline, "Remember, it's only a movie." So we used to always say, like, instead of "don't worry," we used to just say, "it's only a movie. It's only a movie." So we were wise. So in a spiritual context, your pain is not just all the good things you mentioned. The pain is also meaningful. Your pain has meaning, because there's a spiritual context it's pointing you towards, which is your capacity to awaken. And I don't mean, you know, awaken in some big mystical thing. I just mean your capacity to use your time in life to become more and more present and aware, and letting your good heart shine more and more, be more loving, more compassionate. That can give your life meaning. It feels really good to know that, right, I know I just really want to be present and aware. It's a fundamental yearning. Why not use my time to get better and better at being aware and kind and loving. And pain is a pointer to all that. It's a call for awareness, a call for love. So it gives your life meaning. And the Buddhist context, you don't have to believe in the whole cosmology, but the concept is interesting. The cosmology, there's different realms, and there's heavenly realms where beings are just abiding in divine light and living for 900 years. And then there's realms that have a lot more suffering in them. So there's animal realms and hungry ghosts and hell realms and all of that. And in those three realms, it's considered there's too much pain to really be motivated for enlightenment. You lose heart. But the heaven realms, there's too much pleasure. There's no need to look for something deeper, something that actually gives more abiding happiness. Pleasure gives us a kind of happiness, but it's not the deep happiness of equanimity that we're seeking. The human realm is just the right mix of pleasure and pain to motivate us to look for something deeper, but to give us enough pleasure where we don't lose heart. So that's just the Buddhist cosmology. This is the only realm where awakening happens. Regardless of the cosmology, just take that concept. My life has the right mix of pleasure and pain. When it's too easy and it's too complacent, then something jolts me awake, and it's going to be unpleasant. And if we start being conscious, then the pain jolts you again and again, pulls you back to remembering, oh, right, this yearning for being, for presence, that yearning, right, I forgot. The pain can pull you back. It's kind of a fierce teacher. But maybe that ferocity is actually compassion, because time is short and we don't know how much time we have. And I better make the most of it. You know, we each have this precious gift. The best thing that could happen to us has already happened. You were born. We've all been given the best gift we could ever get, this life, this mind, this body. And so pain pulls you back and asks you, are you making the most of it? Not in a guilt-trippy way at all, in a kind way, for this precious mind and body, am I using the gift I got as well as I know I can? So pain is a reminder. And so pain has meaning in the spiritual context. The Tibetan teacher Geshe Gyaltsen said once on a weekend retreat I did with him, think of your pain as a miracle to get you to practice. It makes you dig deeper. I don't know of anyone who's just said, wow, life is so good. I'm just so happy. I better learn how to meditate. We all have come to it because there's something happened that really just didn't work for us. And so we've made a turn to look for something deeper, and something unpleasant, likely, very likely, forced the turn. So pain is good, we could even say. So I'm going to move into the next topic, which is okay. So, and then how do we actually work with it? But let me just see, is there any comment about all that? Question? Response? Do you buy it? Pain is good? You'll take the middle way? It is and it isn't. Fair enough. Right. We all understand how it's not good, so we just, to make it the middle way, we have to think about what's good. Yeah. Yeah. So this is... Pardon?
In degrees.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's almost unbearable.
Sometimes pain is almost unbearable, and a good friend of mine who's a longtime practitioner, she's been practicing 30 years, and she had hip surgery, and she just said it was the most painful experience she could imagine. She hadn't given birth to a child, so, you know, I don't know if it was that bad, but it was extremely hard for her to actually practice in the midst of that. And she's a teacher, so she's clearly committed to it. So pain can be very hard. Can really suck. And pain can really affect you mentally, right? It can make your whole attitude about life more pessimistic and dark and grumpy. I mean, I know just from my own 2 years of dealing with a chronic knee condition, I was surprised to learn that it really affected my moods. So this is not to Pollyanna candy coat it. It sucks, it hurts, it's difficult. But it can have meaning and depth if we bring it into our spiritual path. Please.
I was just going to say that it does, in the brain, which is where all pain resides really, you don't separate the emotional from the physical. It's all one thing. And in fact, it all lights up in all over the brain. There's not one pain center. But if it's an emotional pain, it can be just, it lights up the same area often as somebody's physical pain. So.
And what's the area?
Well, it's all,
just all brain.
But the anterior cingulate gyrus is a big part. People call it the drama queen.
Oh. Say it again. The
anterior cingulate gyrus.
Cingulate? Yeah, with a C, right? Anterior cingulate gyrus. So, yes. So, pain is a neurological perception. The nerves give signals, just like the eye gives signals, and the brain converts it to pain. Emotional pain and physical pain are, you're saying, are the same in the brain.
Right.
Yeah. Today I'm not. Yeah, I'm really talking about physical pain, and because it's just a standalone in the sense that it needs a lot of dedicated attention. But yeah, other retreats I've done and will do on emotional pain. Okay, so how do we actually work with it? So this is part two. And I just want to say a little bit about mind-body, because pain is a very mind-body phenomenon, which is good news, because since the pain is inevitable, then the mind can come in to work with the relationship to pain. And that's how we take the suffering out. We can be in pain without suffering. And mindfulness is one way. We can actually be okay mentally even if there's physical pain. So obviously it's just an idea that we separate mind and body. We even separate mind and brain, right? So we think of brain because it's physical as body. And mind, because mind is not physical, mind is subjective and experiential, as separate. And in a way they are. But how can we separate mind and brain? How can we separate mind and body? So the mind is actually not just in the brain. The mind is distributed in the body. We could even say the brain isn't just in the brain. There are neurons in the heart. There are neurons in our digestive system. And they are chock full of information. So in a heart transplant, the nerves between the heart and the brain take a while to actually connect in the body once the heart transplant's done, to actually start sending signals. The heart does its own beating. It beats itself through its own neurons. And so it's not just the heart. Our whole gut, which technically is called the enteric nervous system, the ENS, has neurons that line the walls of the gut from the esophagus all the way to the rectum. 9 meters, 100 million neurons, 30 neurotransmitters in our enteric nervous system inside your gut. And similar to the heart, the nervous system of the gut can control itself independently of the brain. And we have gut feelings, and our gut can affect our mood. And the interesting thing is 90% of the neuronal connections between brain and gut go this way, go from the gut to the brain. Only 10% are the brain going to the gut. We think that the brain's in charge of everything, but most of what's happening between brain and gut is information going to the brain. Very little, information going the other way. And we can feel that. You know, sometimes we have butterflies in the stomach. That's like a mental state. Or we might have a gut feeling, an intuition that we feel. So we don't really understand body-mind very well. We don't understand mind-matter very well in general. So the Buddhist tradition is rife with stories of people who develop very strong powers of concentration doing bizarre things. And there's a book about one of our grand teachers. So Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, who started the Insight tradition mostly in this country, others too, but they're some of the main ones. One of their main teachers was Dipa Ma, and she was a lay practitioner. She was a very, very awake being, and she also developed very strong powers of concentration, and she could do bizarre things. She could actually hover. She could walk through walls. She could just do, I've heard Sharon Salzberg talk about this, and you can read about it in a book called Knee Deep in Grace. It's all about Dipa Ma. She was an amazing, amazing woman from India. And you can see pictures of Joseph Goldstein and Dipa Ma. Dipa Ma was about 4'11". Joseph Goldstein's about, 6'6" or something, like this little tiny woman, his teacher. She had developed intense powers of concentration. So we don't understand mind-matter, and we don't understand mind-body. So just I'm saying all this so that we really get it, that, there's actually a lot of power I have with my mind to work with my pain, to work with the physical experience in my body. So one really common mind-body experience with pain is that reactivity towards anxiety about pain makes the pain worse. Because that mental resistance then shows up as tension in the body. And tension in the body adds to the pain wherever it's just pure physical pain. And then the anxiety about pain actually makes the pain feel worse subjectively. So this is good news, because it means we can use our mind to ease the situation. Just throwing in a little humor here, because it's going to lead to a point. So there's a comedian, David Bader, who writes about Zen Judaism, all about the humorous intersection of Buddhism and Judaism. He's got a book called For You, A Little Enlightenment. So this comes from his psycho-Semitic side. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single oi. Be here now. Be someplace else later. Is that so complicated? To find the Buddha, look within. Deep inside you are 10,000 flowers. Each flower blossoms 10,000 times. Each blossom has 10,000 petals. You might want to see a specialist. Though only your skin, sinews, and bone remain, though your flesh and blood dry up and wither away, yet shall you meditate and not stir until you have attained full enlightenment. But first, a little nosh. Be aware of your body. Be aware of your perceptions. Keep in mind that every physical sensation is not a symptom of terminal illness. So, the last one is the key one. It's essentially a lesson in pain management. Thinking mind is the cause of all the suffering around pain. It's not the pain that causes the suffering. It's our relationship with it. And so the Buddha talked about this in the story of the two arrows. He said, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he, and we could insert she, or a gender-neutral pronoun, so he feels two pains, physical and mental. Just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pain of two arrows. As he is touched by that painful feeling, he is resistant. And this resistance obsesses him. The well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, when touched with a feeling of pain, does not sorrow, grieve, or lament, does not beat his breast or become distraught. He only feels one pain, physical, not mental. Just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterwards did not shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pain of only one arrow. So, the first arrows always come. The second arrow is optional. And we do that basically by dropping resistance and opening to or allowing what's unpleasant to be unpleasant. What we're doing right there is dropping the argument with reality, dropping the stress. And this has a huge impact on our physical well-being. Something like 60 to 90% of doctor visits are due to a stress-related medical condition. So here's a bunch of conditions where stress makes it worse. It's not the only cause, but it can make it much worse. Neck and back pain, headaches, asthma, frequent colds, fatigue, tinnitus, hives, intestinal cramps, heartburn. The stress about it only makes it worse. So we can do something. We can change our attitude. And we can do it through our practice. And the trick is to work with pain when it's here, to open to it directly, as we've been doing. We don't ever go to some enlightened cloud where we're free of the flux of pleasure and pain. That's not what awakening does. The Buddha died of food poisoning. That must have been pretty painful, to have food poisoning so bad you died of it. He did not transcend pleasure and pain. He did not get out of pleasure and pain. But we could say he transcended it in the sense of being bigger than it, but with his mental attitude. And so the key is mindfulness. We can replace the resistance with curiosity. That's the crux move that we're doing, right? So we feel something unpleasant in the body, and our usual reaction is, oh no, not that. We don't want it, even if it's just a tiny little itch. You know, we get very reactive very quickly. So what the key move is to replace the energy of reacting to the energy of curiosity. We just open to it. We turn towards and we allow and we get curious. Oh, it's like this and all the things we've been doing. How big is it? Is it uniform? Does it change? Am I creating a story around it? We can even be curious about that. So that's the essence of what we do. And I hope today, as you work with pain, that you're titrating it. That you're not just only going for it's super intense. If you're in intense pain today, I really encourage you to lie down or stand up, take a break, because it's hard to open only to intense pain. So we have to titrate. But we can actually open to unpleasantness much more than we think. The real problem with pain is not the pain, it's some attitude, usually of resistance. We usually think in this culture, because of how we're conditioned, if I'm in pain, something's wrong. We don't just accept that maybe it's just pain. If we can accept, then we can go to, it's okay. I can actually handle this. We resist it because we get caught in catastrophic thinking about it. We resist it because we get caught in time. If you have a chronic condition, an ongoing condition, and some pain erupts, typically what happens is we're like, oh no, not this again. That's bringing in the past. And, oh my gosh, when will this ever end? That's bringing in the future. And so we resist because we're bearing this burden of a self continuous in time, as if the pain is still happening from a year ago. And, you know, I've had to learn this again and again and again, to really watch those thoughts. Oh my gosh, here I am, 6 months out of a minor knee surgery, you know, meniscus repair. And this is going so badly. I can't believe I'm still in this much pain. And of course, we do that. But it's optional. I don't have to. So again and again and again in my own practice, I've had to just let go of that, because that is an added burden to the difficulty of just being with the pain in the body. All of a sudden, I'm having to deal with 6 months of pain and a botched surgery. I don't have to do that. I can just relate directly to the unpleasantness, and I drop out of time, and I'm dropping a real load when I do that. And we often find that the pain in our body on the 1 to 10 scale, you know, might be 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6. But if we look at the mental suffering around it, it can be 8, 9, and 10 when it's just 2 in the body. So that's really powerful to see. Oh, the biggest issue usually with physical pain is how I'm thinking about it. So we resist it because of catastrophizing, because of bringing in time. And we also resist it because we really do have this construct in our mind that pain is over here, and I'm over here, and the pain is happening to me. And that actually is a misperception. So let's try a little experiment. So if you would take one of your fingers and bend it. And bend it back to the point of discomfort. And feel discomfort. And just as we've done with any sensation we've been aware of, get the extent of it. Does this pain come into the palm, into the wrist, into the forearm? And we'll go a little longer. So if you want, you could intensify a little bit, maybe to the point where it's painful, but not very painful, just a little painful. Just feel it and relax. Relax. Does it go past your elbow? Just feel. Does it go up into your shoulder? Feel. Does it come up into the center of your brain and light up the little mini-me that we take to be ourselves? Or does the pain stop somewhere in the space of your arm? Just feel. And then go ahead, release. Did that actually cause physical pain up into the brain? Can you find the self that the pain was happening to? Those are words and ideas that don't match the experience. And so correct me if I'm wrong, but your experience was discomfort, going to pain, hopefully mild, and that experience ending somewhere in the arm. Did anyone not have that experience? Okay, so we all had that experience. And that's a tangible, concrete experience you had. And you can describe it, and, you know, I just did. Now, what's the self that pain happened to? Describe that. There was none of that in the experience. You might have had a thought, oh, that's happening to me. But a thought can never be the self, because thoughts come and go like crazy. And we take the self to be this abiding thing. So if you have the thought, it's happening to me, guess what? If the thought isn't there, then it isn't happening to you, because it only exists with the logic of the thought. Now, this is getting really subtle. It's kind of an advanced part of working with pain. But it shows you at least, I hope, a glimmer of how we can be free with pain. Pain afflicts us mostly because we take it to be an unpleasant experience that's afflicting me. But actually, with awareness you see that it's just an unpleasant experience. There's no you it's happening to. It's just happening. So that might not be available in your practice. And if it isn't, then it doesn't matter, because you can still be mindful with pain as I've been guiding us. But the reason meditators, as they get more experience in the practice, can sit with intense pain is because they can start to understand that the pain itself is just sensation. And remember how I guided you into to notice the difference between sensation in the hand and your image of hand, your thought of hand? And that, at first, is a real subtlety that you might not even notice. But over time, you can start to notice it. Oh, there's the image hand, then there's the thought, my hand. But your experience of hand physically is just buzz, tingle, throb, pulse. There actually isn't a hand there through our tactile experience. And so the more you get used to this, not just with pain, but with any sensation in the body, the more you get used to just feeling the body as sensation alone, then the easier it is to work with pain when it arises. And so if it's not something you are experiencing in your practice, at least know this is where the practice goes. This is how we can come to ease when the body's in pain. Really, an experience of pain in space. Instead of pain that's afflicting me. Again, maybe it's just a glimmer for you, but that's where the practice heads. So when we turn towards, as I've guided us, we experience sensation, and we experience the size of it. Is it uniform? Is it changing? We notice the difference between sensation and thought or image about it. We notice that the trouble is almost always more in the story about it than in the experience. As we notice the difference between thoughts and sensation, we drop out of time. We drop out of the catastrophes. Oh my gosh, every physical symptom isn't a sign of terminal illness. And we can even drop, as practice matures, this sense that there's pain happening to me. There's just unpleasantness. That's what happens in the body. So that's all in the turn towards. And then we turn away because it's tiring to only focus on pain. And we can get obsessive about pain. We need to understand there's other things happening. So we turn away in the body, or we turn to sound. Another helpful turn away is compassion. We can really open to a sense of self-compassion when we're in pain. Like an understanding grandparent, I'm sorry it's hard. I wish it wasn't hard. Compassion. So that's really helpful as another option when you want to turn the attention away. And when all else fails and you've really given it a good try in your practice and it's just not working right then skillful distraction, really important. Non-meditative distraction is very important to regulate you and so you don't get disheartened. So if you're really in a chronic pain situation, even if you can open to it, 10 minutes here and there in a day is really positive. Think of that as very positive. You might spend a lot of time in skillful distraction. But all these benefits are available should you choose to open to this mindfully so you can drop the resistance. So, and one really skillful turn away, I mean, there's many skillful ones, talking to a friend, a loved one, a partner, you know, getting relational, getting out in nature, relating to animals. You know, there's many, many things we can do. And also just looking for what's good can be a really helpful turn away. What's good in your life? There's lots of good. A really important principle when you're in pain is don't make decisions or conclusions, because the thoughts you have are really conditioned by the unpleasantness in the body. You're going to be thinking your darkest, most pessimistic thoughts when you're in pain. Don't believe them. Don't make decisions. Just deal with the pain as best you can, and then skillfully distract away without conclusion, without decisions. And when you're more in a balanced place, then you can sort of think about what you can do. So another skillful turn away, skillful distraction, is humor, you know? You know the formula, right? Tragedy plus time equals humor. That's kind of like a, you know. And we can be humorous about anything, everything. We can be humorous about meditating. It's kind of funny, isn't it, what we do? When Ajahn Chah, a very, very awake teacher from Thailand, came to Insight Meditation Society. In Thailand, they don't do slow walking as much. In Burma, it's apparently more common, and Joseph Goldstein's main teacher was Burmese, so there's this style of really slow walking at IMS in Massachusetts. And so all these people are doing this really slow walking. And Ajahn Chah is like, wow, I've come to the insane asylum out here in this beautiful countryside. You know, we know this from being on retreat. I mean, have you ever watched the movie Groundhog Day? That's like a movie about being on retreat. It's the same day over and over and over and over, and it eventually wears you out and you become kind and loving. It's a beautiful movie about being on retreat. And here's the cartoonist, Bruce Kaplan. Also maybe a retreat humor. You're a car driving along. Billboard says, your own tedious thoughts, next 200 miles. And we all, you know, we understand the drama, right, that happens on your cushion, right? This is a meditator just falling madly in love. This is a meditator in a total tantrum. This is a meditator just racked with jealousy, in total full-on bliss. It's kind of funny what we do. Or you're on retreat, you know, and you're doing walking meditation, and it's really slow, and we're supposed to be lifting the foot and moving and placing the foot, and but often it's just lifting, moving, spacing, and the mind wanders to life's eternal questions. Why can't you tickle yourself? If you want to do double your homeopathic dose, do you cut it in half? If I stayed up all night researching the internet to see if I'm an internet addict, does that mean I am an internet addict? What sadist would put an S in the word lisp? What sadist would name a memory drug? Phosphatidylserine. Does anyone take that? I take that. I'm like, that is cruel to call a memory drug that. So this happens on retreat. We just, we spin out. We can lighten up. Really important to lighten up. Look for humor. I mean, and we can be really mindless when we look for humor. But then sometimes you find the nuggets. Just the other night, I was looking at like preposterous pictures you see in the airport, and there's a picture of like the TSA line, but you can see the back of a TSA attendant and the computer screen. And instead of it being a bag, it's actually a picture of online solitaire, on the computer screen. I can't even remember the other pictures I saw, but they were really funny. Oh, there's one of Turkish Airlines, and it's a jet in the sky, beautiful, but it's on a going down escalator. So it looks like the jet is just about to crash into the floor. So I don't know if this is true, but I did hear this. The Chevy Nova, they tried to market it in Latin America. Anyone speak Spanish? Nova. The Chevy Nova. The Chevy, it doesn't go. Not a good name for a car in Latin America. So humor is out there. Look for it. If you have chronic pain, it's really fun. Just find it and write it down, share it with a friend. It's good. So let me stop with that and invite questions, comments. Please.
I was just actually thinking, relative to keeping pain over time, what the mind does, and then how that gets reinforced too, even in relationship. So how are you doing today? Like other people constantly kind of keeping it in time too, and how challenging it is in that regard. And I'm just wondering how you worked with that with your knee.
Oh, yeah. It was a challenge, and if you have any kind of chronic condition, I'm sure you get it all the time, very well-meaning people, just wondering how you're doing, feeling very caring, but you have to repeat, the story of your condition for the 100th time that day. And so that's hard, yeah. And so I did get to the point saying, I'm sorry, but I've already reached my limit of talking about it today, but thank you so much for caring. The wise response if someone asks you how you're doing is just talk about how you're doing right now. Because that's what we know. So it's like this right now. How are you doing? Well, I'm good right now. I'm not so good right now. Just add that in. And then people don't have to, deflect you into time as much.
Drugs.
Very important. Why not? What kind of drugs? Pain drugs or?
A little morphine is nice.
Oh, a little morphine. again, and this is a whole big can of worms, yeah? If drugs had no side effects, it would be really different. But because of side effects, we have to be very careful about what we do.
It's a big industry. I mean, you know, everything from ibuprofen, aspirin, to morphine, you know.
Right.
How your condition is.
Right.
It does relieve the pain, though.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
So we're lucky. You know, we're lucky it's not like the Civil War times, where I probably would have been amputated,
right.
You know? So we're really lucky in a lot of ways. 50 years from now, they'll look back at our medicine and say, wow, that was barbaric. But so again, the principle being we need to titrate the pain every way we can. And please make the choice more than you do to open to it mindfully. Because you can do it more than you think you can. And there is pain relief with mindfulness. Mindfulness, medication, no negative side effects. No hangover, no addiction. If you could get addicted to it, it would be wonderful. Well, alcohol is very problematic as a pain, you know, titrator.
Just one other thing about, we have so many belief systems around pain that get in our way. And I think sometimes just questioning your thought about, you know, we're in the soup, so it's hard to know whether it's true or not. But,
yeah. Oh.
Things like that, you know, that walking actually makes things better, not worse, if you have moderate arthritis.
Uh-huh.
So I think there are a lot of, there's a guy named Mario Martinez who wrote the Mind-Body Code, and it really is instructive around that.
Great.
Just questioning our beliefs.
Right. So that would be one belief we have about pain, that walking is bad for arthritis. You're saying it's the opposite. Walking is actually helpful for mild arthritis. Yeah. Any others that come to mind?
That we don't necessarily have to have more pain as we get older.
Oh.
That's another one.
Great. Glad you said that. We don't have to have more pain as we age.
Right.